This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
Thank you all very much for coming out today.
That, of course, Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho opening a news conference where he tried to explain why he pleaded guilty to a disorderly conduct charge that stems from an allegation of lewd conduct in an airport men's bathroom. The story dominates the cable news channels, the blogs, the water coolers, particularly impressive in a week that saw the resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, a dogged bickering match over the Florida primary schedule, and Senator Tim Johnson's return to South Dakota after a long illness. We're glad it's Wednesday and time for a supersized edition of the Political Junkie.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
But I'm the decider.
Ken Rudin is back. He's NPR's political editor, writes the weekly Political Junkie column at NPR.org. And we want to hear from all of you political junkies. If you have questions about Larry Craig's political future, the primary fight, Tim Johnson's return, or any of the rest of the week's political news, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can always weigh in on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Later in the hour, a funeral is a time to say something nice about someone who's passed on, but what if there's nothing nice to say? Eulogizing difficult people. But first, Ken Rudin and an extra-large political junkie. Hey, Ken.
Not much to talk about this week.
Oh, no, very quiet. But by way of introduction to the week's top political story, let's hear more from Senator Craig's explanation of the incident in the airport men's bathroom.
While I was not involved in any inappropriate conduct at the Minneapolis airport or anywhere else, I chose to plead guilty to a lesser charge in hopes of making it go away. I did not seek any counsel, either from an attorney, staff, friends, or family. That was a mistake, and I deeply regret it. Because of that, I have now retained counsel, and I am asking counsel to review this matter and to advise me on how to proceed.
So Senator Craig pleaded guilty to make it all go away.
It's amazing that it hasn't come out until now. It happened in early June in Minneapolis, and he pleaded guilty in August, early August, but the fact that it's taken this long to come out, so to speak, but also the fact that he did not tell his wife, he did not tell his family, did not tell his attorney, and obviously nobody in the political world knew about it. But again, you know, Larry Craig was first elected to Congress in 1980. Since at least 1982, there have been allegations, there have been rumors, there's been innuendo that about his sexual orientation. He has denied it for at least the 25 years. He's been says these charges are ridiculous, they're just not true. And of course, yesterday he had the very surreal press conference that announced that he's not gay and he never has been gay.
And he makes a decision, as I understand it, next month in September, as to whether he plans to run for re-election.
He's been saying that for several months now, even before this latest development came out. He said that he'll announce. He was one of the few members of the Senate who have not announced his plans yet. And everybody I've spoken to said there's absolutely no way they can see how Larry Craig could survive this. Many people are predicting actually a resignation before his term is out, but certainly not running for re-election.
He claimed that this was at least due in part to an eight-month-long investigation of his sexual orientation by a local newspaper there in Boise, Idaho, The Statesman. And you would think that given that allegation, a lot of Republicans in Washington, D.C. would have leapt to his defense.
Well, they certainly did. Matter of fact, what I was most struck by was even before Senator Craig had his news conference yesterday, the Senate Republican leadership led by Mitch McConnell, Trent Lott, and others called for a Senate Ethics Committee investigation of Larry Craig's activities. So, you know, you could see that even the leadership is not standing by him. Mitt Romney, Larry Craig was a key endorser of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. There was actually a video on Mitt Romney's website that you saw Larry Craig's talking about how he likes Mitt Romney because of his family values. That video immediately disappeared from Mitt Romney's campaign website.
There is, however, another video on the YouTube website. This from NBC's Meet the Press a long time ago, played last night on TV by Chris Matthews. Craig severely chastising former President Clinton.
The Senate certainly can bring about a censure resolution,
and it's a slap on the wrist. It's a bad boy, Bill Clinton. You're a naughty boy. The American people already know that Bill Clinton is a bad boy, a naughty boy. I'm going to speak out for the citizens of my state who, in the majority, think that Bill Clinton is probably even a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Well, we're joined now by a veteran Idaho political watcher. Jim Weatherby is a professor emeritus of public policy at Boise State University. He joins us from the studios of Boise State Radio in Idaho. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good to be here, Neil.
And could you imagine anything better than that clip we just heard if you were running a campaign against Larry Craig?
Oh, my goodness. I'm a political junkie like you people are, but I hate to hear that. That's a tough one. And Larry Craig, because he did not resign and because he tried to explain away his arrest, is now fodder for all of these videos and late-night comics and all of the discussion on talk radio.
What is the reaction there in Idaho? Sometimes when one of your own is pilloried, people rally to his cause.
Well, this is a rather difficult circumstance and different one, as you and Ken noted. We in Idaho didn't hear about this until the Roll Call newspaper broke this story just a couple of days ago. So there was a lot of shock in Idaho. And now I think largely a negative reaction setting in, not on the details of the charge, but the fact that Larry Craig pleaded guilty. He may now use the statesman made me do it defense, but it's not playing very well, at least at this point in Idaho.
And for the statesmen, have they been running headlines every day for the past 8 months, Larry Craig is gay?
No. The statesmen did commission one of their reporters to do a multi-month investigation of all of these rumors that have dogged Larry Craig since at least the 1980s. But they really didn't find anything substantial. No source to really come forward, and we're sitting on the story until the national headlines came out that that Craig had pleaded guilty, and in some ways giving some validation to this story and opening up the door for the statesman yesterday to publish this. But prior to that, the statesman had been sitting on the story and had conducted a very long interview with Larry Craig and his wife in May, just weeks before this incident in the Minneapolis airport.
Hmm. I wonder also, he has basically thrown down the gauntlet at this point to anybody. I mean, he says, you can't prove this.
Denial? And maybe it works. I don't know how. What are the legs with this story? Senator Vitter was challenged in Louisiana. Continues to deny that. Apparently, this is Craig's strategy at this point. But he had, I think, a very ineffective press conference. He would not stand for any questions, and I think Idahoans still have a lot of questions about what happened and why he pleaded guilty.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin and with Jim Weatherby, a professor emeritus of public policy at Boise State University. And joining us on the line is Darren. Darren calling us from America Falls. And is that Minnesota?
No, American Falls, Idaho.
Idaho. Go ahead, please.
I think this is very similar to Senator Sims from Idaho, who also had some indiscretions. And the party moved then to find a replacement for him. I think Senator Craig will put up a good fight, but in the end, he will resign and be replaced by probably Jim Risch or Mike Simpson, and the Republicans will still keep the seat, but they will replace this and take care of it in-house.
Mm-hmm. Darren, you sound like you're well-informed on all of this.
Well, I'm a Idaho political junkie.
I see. All right. I wonder, Ken Rudin, what do you make of his analysis?
I agree completely. I think it's no Democrat has won a Senate seat in a Senate election in Idaho since 1974. Obviously, the Democrats would love to see Larry Craig run for a fourth term. Their candidate is Larry LaRocco, likely candidate Larry LaRocco, the former congressman who was ousted in the 94 Republican takeover. But I guess Jim Risch, the lieutenant governor, he has said from the beginning that he would love to run for the seat if Larry Craig doesn't run, and I assume he'll be the Republican nominee and keep the seat Republican.
Mm-hmm. And do those names sound about right to you, Jim Weatherby?
Yes, they do. Ken is right in terms of Risch, and Darren is, and the possibility that Congressman Mike Simpson might get into this race as well.
Thanks very much for the call, Darren.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
So long. Let's turn now to this is Alan. Alan with us from Watertown in Minnesota.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hey, one of the hundred most intelligent, one of the 100 most powerful men in America, maybe the world, is trying to get us to believe that he pled guilty by accident to something that he had no involvement in. You know, maybe up in Minnesota we're just a little more skeptical than the rest of the world, but is there anybody that believes him?
Well, it's unclear at this point. Ken Rudin, is there anybody who believes him?
No, as I said earlier, the fact is the Republican leadership didn't even wait to hear his press conference. They have already called for an ethics committee. I don't know what an ethics investigation can do, because obviously Larry Craig didn't enrich himself, didn't do anything that compromised his ability as a senator. But clearly that his colleagues on Capitol Hill, there's no rallying around him at all.
And Jim Weatherby, he's got to be stuck. He either lied to in the signing the plea agreement, which is lying to a judge, which in some circumstances could be described as perjury, or he came out yesterday at that news conference and lied to everybody.
Lied to everybody, or is guilty, as I heard on talk radio at a couple of different stations in Idaho, of poor judgment in handling of this case. The 2 months between the charge and the guilty plea, not consulting attorney, and pleading guilty to this case. You might, the question was about, is anyone defending him? There are a few. The chair of the Idaho Republican Party is supporting him. Senator Mike Crapo has indicated support. But by and large, both Idaho Democrats and Republicans are pretty silent on this issue at this point.
Well, Alan, thanks very much for the call. And Jim Weatherby, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Jim Weatherby, Professor Emeritus of Public Policy at Boise State University, joined us from Boise State Radio in Idaho. Political junkie Ken Rudin will stay with us. If you'd like to get in on the conversation as we go on to talk about the penalties that the state of Florida may face from the Democratic National Committee, about the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez, and other political news, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A week tailor-made for our political junkie segment with Senator Larry Craig's men's room problems. The attorney general is out. Senator Tim Johnson is back. And the Democratic Party laid down the law in Florida, taking away their delegates for the convention if they don't move their primary back to a respectable part of the year. We'll talk more about all of that in just a moment. Ken Rudin is here. He's NPR's political editor. You can read more of his take on Senator Craig's problems in his latest column online now at NPR.org. It's called, guess what? The Political Junkie. If you have questions about the primary fight, Tim Johnson's return, or any of the rest of the week's political news, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. And let's go to Peter. Peter's with us from Mountain View in California.
Yeah, I really enjoy the Political Junkie segment. But I was interested in the reaction of the Christian evangelicals to, you know, this Republican Party, the party of God, from their perspective. What's going on with, you know, time after time, their party disappointing them?
Mm-hmm. Ken?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think that had a lot to do with the Republicans' loss of both the House and Senate in 2006. The mark, in addition to everything else that was going on, the war and President Bush's numbers and things like that, the Mark Foley congressional page scandal that went on for far too long for the Republicans. It just stayed there and stayed there. Then Speaker Dennis Hastert just perhaps didn't do as much as he could. Republicans were pointing fingers at each other. And the combination of a sex scandal and the Jack Abramoff scandal made a lot of Christian evangelicals say, is this the party that we believe in all this time, given the fact that their moral compass may be a bit askew?
And it's more than Senator Craig, who's clearly got some splaining to do. And there are still other Republican senators facing problems, Ted Stevens in Alaska, and in terms of a corruption investigation, and again, sex charges of Senator Vitter in Louisiana.
Right, and the Republicans just lost another congressman, Rick Renzi of Arizona, who was involved in a kickback scandal. He announced last week that he would not run for re-election. So that culture of corruption that Nancy Pelosi loved and the Democrats loved to talk about in 2006, that may not have disappeared. And the Republicans, it's coming at the worst possible time for the Republican Party, given the fact that the war is so unpopular, given the fact that there's still dissatisfaction with the Republican presidential field.
And we should say that, of course, Democrats face some problems, too. Congressman Jefferson in New Orleans is still facing trial.
That's true. I mean, it's a bipartisan culture of corruption, but of course, it certainly worked for the Democrats in 2006, and it doesn't seem to have as much legs for the Republicans this time.
Thanks very much for the call, Peter.
Sure, thanks.
And while we're on senators from the upper parts of the country, there was a more positive story this week. After a long illness, it was the return of Senator Tim Johnson, the Democrat from South Dakota, who appeared last night in his home state for the first time since a stroke.
And I promise you all that I will work harder than ever for you and for our state. Not everyone gets a second chance at life. My commitment to you for my second chance at life is to make you and all South Dakotans the beneficiary of that gift.
Tim Johnson obviously still speaking with some difficulty. Ken Rudin, but nice to see him back on his feet.
It was a very emotional time. This is the first time he's been in South Dakota since he suffered the cerebral hemorrhage back in December. Again, you know, this is a 51-49 Senate. If Tim Johnson were unable to continue in his duties or perhaps died, a Republican governor would most likely have a Republican appointment, and you'd have a 50-50 Senate, which would be a Vice President Cheney making it a Republican Senate. So obviously a lot of Democrats were holding their breath at Tim Johnson, and it was very reassuring, not only to Democrats too, but Republicans, to watch somebody who just came from a near fatal illness and to come back and at least seems to be recovering.
Let's get Debbie on the line. Debbie is calling us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess since Senator Johnson had this since December, there's really been a problem with Democrats, because there is always that one empty seat, and so there hasn't been a whole lot of ties. But I guess with him being up for election in 2008, I mean, just the reality is he going to have the mental capacity and the healthy vitality to be able to continue with his job? I think that's really going to be a factor.
It's a hard question, Ken, but a fair one.
It's an absolute question, and both parties are watching that very carefully. Tim Johnson did say yesterday that he intends to run for a third term. He won, 5 years ago when he lost to beat John Thune, he beat him by 524 votes. So obviously politics is very, very closely contested in South Dakota. It's a Republican state, but Tim Johnson is a moderate Democrat who seems to be winning a lot of support among the Republican voters. But having said that, he did not look especially good. I mean, of course, he looked better than he did several months earlier, but the question is whether he is up for not only a very grueling reelection bid, but also 6 more years in the Senate. He has been raising a lot of money. A lot of his colleagues have raised a lot of money on his behalf, but the question that you raise is exactly what a lot of people are asking.
Can I ask another question?
If you keep it quick, Debbie. Yeah.
If the money that he raises is there in the bank account with his name on it, so to speak, for reelection, if he did decide not to run in 2008, what's the restriction? I mean, what's the limit that he could transfer to the Democrat candidate?
Well, it's my understanding, that's a good question, my understanding that he could probably give a lot of it to the Democratic State Committee. Obviously, there are limits which you can give an individual candidate, but there are less limits, less restrictions on giving it to the party at large.
Well, it'll be a race to watch.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Debbie. Florida's Democratic delegates issued a statement yesterday saying they may sue the Democratic National Committee to keep the DNC from stripping the state of its nominating delegates at the National Convention. Congresswoman Corinne Brown of Florida's 3rd District is one of those who signed the statement. She joins us now by phone from Florida. And Representative Brown, nice to have you on the program.
Fine. I'm happy to be here.
Now, why the Democratic National Committee established rules and regulations about when states can have their primaries. Florida violated those rules by scheduling their primary earlier than the DNC stipulated. Why can't they punish you?
Okay, let's be clear. Florida Democrats can't accept can't set when the election is going to be held. The legislature sets that, and the legislature is completely controlled by Republicans. The House, the Senate, and the governor, they determine when we're going to have the primary. So the idea of punishing 4 million Democrats because the Republicans changed the date is unheard of. We're one of the largest states. We're the fourth largest state. We have 210 delegates, and you're telling me that when you have that roll call vote, Florida is going to be zero. That is unacceptable. All of the candidates come to Florida for money. They come for support. We are going to determine who's going to be the next president of the United States. And to say that all Democrats in Florida are going to be punished by the Democratic Party is unacceptable. We've had this before. We've been disenfranchised in the 2000 election. It is not acceptable, and we will sue. We're all going to the convention. We're going to be seated, and we're going to count.
A fascinating, convincing, compelling argument, which when made to the Democratic National Committee last Saturday, convinced absolutely nobody.
Okay, so the point is nobody is listening. We're going to mount a grassroots campaign and ask the donors not to give to the Democratic National Convention. That's one way. And the second is that we're looking at possible lawsuit. But thirdly, we're going to the convention. We're going to the convention. Florida, all 210 of us will be at that convention if it's going to be a convention. And it is ludicrous that we have this fight with the Democratic Party.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. Fernando joins us on the phone from Miami.
Hello, sir. Good day.
Hi.
Yes, I absolutely commend Representative Brown. We are being completely disenfranchised. Look, I'm Cuban, and for years this has been a Republican bastion that they can count on the Cuban vote. But just recently, there's been a burgeoning Democratic movement. Younger Cubans, younger Latin people who have been raised in this country are moving towards the Democratic Party. And now, all of a sudden, they take that away from us. They remove this primary because of the tyranny of Iowa and New Hampshire. Lily white Iowa and New Hampshire, with economies that would disappear within our state, and a populace that doesn't represent the nation as a whole. Why should we be held to this standard when, in all honesty, the only reason that Iowa and New Hampshire exist today is because it's cheap to buy ads there?
Congresswoman Brown, it sounds like you've got more than 210 people willing to come to the convention.
Everybody is on the same accord here. I mean, we don't control when the legislature determines, you know, when we're going to have the primary. That is completely controlled. We can't even agenda a bill in Tallahassee without the Republicans saying okay. So you're going to say because the Republican House, Senate, and governor changed the date, you're going to disenfranchise 4 million Democrats in Florida. Now, that is not acceptable, and this rule was done a couple of years ago. Well, we didn't know what was going to happen, and even if we did, we couldn't change it because we don't control the legislature.
Ken Rudin, the DNC finds itself in an awkward position. It says these are the rules. On the other hand, Congresswoman Brown makes clear, this saying we've been disenfranchised, particularly in Florida, is going to have a lot of resonance come the convention.
Well, it does. And I mean, I'm not sure if blaming the Republican legislature is the right way to go, only because the same thing is happening in Michigan with a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature, and they're also talking about moving their caucus or primary, whatever they decide to do, to January 15th. That would also be in violation of the DNC, and the DNC will no doubt probably have rules or, you know, prohibitions against Michigan. But that's also a Democratic legislature that did it.
Well, what I'm saying is they've already said that they voted to strip all Florida 210 delegates. They're not talking about what might happen. They've already voted to do that.
If in 30 days Florida has not changed its mind.
Okay, we're not going to change it. We cannot change it. We don't control what happens in Tallahassee. So you're going to tell me that we're going to be penalized because of what the Republican-controlled legislature has done. That is unacceptable to me. That is unacceptable to all Democratic Floridians. Why do I have to spend my energy and my time fighting the Democratic National Committee? I don't know, but we're prepared to do whatever it takes to make sure that we are not disenfranchised in Florida. We know what happened in 2000 in the election. A lot of minorities in this state was disenfranchised. Their votes wasn't counted. So you're going to tell me now the Democratic Party is not going to count the Democratic votes.
Congresswoman Brown, didn't the Democrats in the state legislature also vote for the earlier primary?
Yes, they did. But keep in mind, they voted for it because they put a paper trail as a part of the bill. But whether they voted for it or not means nothing because they can't pass a bill in Tallahassee. They don't have the numbers in Tallahassee. Do you understand what I'm saying?
We understand what you're saying, Congresswoman. Thanks so much for being with us today, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Corinne Brown, the Congresswoman who represents Florida's 3rd District, joins us by phone today from Florida. You're listening to The Political Junkie. NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, Ken, this dispute is not likely to be resolved anytime soon.
Neil, why can't you get guests who have really strong opinions on the issue?
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this will be Sierra. Sierra is with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Yes, I get to watch the legislature every day. You know, why can't they just have all the primaries on one day? I mean, is this like an ego thing with the states? Like, ooh, I want to come in first? Who cares? Just have it all on the same day and have it done with.
Every television station in Des Moines and in New Hampshire and a bunch in Boston, too. Ken Rudin?
That's exactly the problem. The problem is everybody wants to be first. In the old days, they would be later in the schedule. And, of course, you know, by the time you get to March, April, May, no. But see, that's another Democrat complaining. But the fact is that unless you're first, you don't matter. Because once Iowa and New Hampshire decide, we saw that in 2000, we saw that in 2004, Al Gore won Iowa, New Hampshire, it was over. When John Kerry won Iowa, New Hampshire, it was over. Every state wants to move up. They don't want to be left behind. And, of course, by moving up so close to the front that Iowa and New Hampshire now feel threatened. And there's even some talk about Iowa, New Hampshire moving into 2007, which shows how ludicrous this whole thing is. And that's why the DNC wants to have some kind of semblance of normalcy, even though this is hardly normal.
Wouldn't doing it all in one day solve that problem?
Well, it would. It would be. I mean, you almost have that now. On February 5th, you have like 20 to 25 states already committing to primaries and caucuses. But when you do that, you don't have buyer's remorse, and that is if the winner of the one-day national primary suddenly falls on his or her face come March, April, May, there's no recourse for the party.
Hmm. Sierra, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's an email we have from Arch in Fort Lauderdale in Florida. Now that all of the Bush Texas inner circle has left or is leaving the administration, it seems only Karen Hughes is left. Of course, she left and came back. What's she been doing as ambassador of public diplomacy at the State Department, and how effective has she been?
I have no idea. What I like about this call is that, you know, we always talk about George Bush being a lame duck, and we said that after 2006 when the Democrats took over the House and Senate. And then when you lose somebody who's been with you for so many years, like Karl Rove, like Alberto Gonzalez, you almost feel more isolated than ever, and you turn to the few friends you have left. Clay Johnson, I think, was the head of personnel in the early Bush administration. He's another Texan who's still with him along with Karen Hughes. But the point is, I remember what happened with Ronald Reagan in the end of 1986-87 after Iran-Contra. He lost a lot of his people and a lot of Washington insiders replaced his inner circle, people like Howard Baker. And almost Howard Baker was able to reach out to Democrats to somehow end the tensions, the partisan tensions. I don't know. It may be too late for the Bush administration. This has been a very partisan era, very partisan administration. But perhaps, you know, by having to reach across party lines, to have some people who could reach across and talk to Democrats might salvage what's left for the next 18 months of the Bush administration.
And we just have a few seconds left, but we can't ignore the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which, of course, the country's greatest natural disaster, but also an event with considerable political ramifications.
There's no question about that. As bad and as unpopular as the war in Iraq is, I feel that the beginning of the end of the Bush administration came when, with its reaction or lack of reaction to what happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Ken Rudin, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Neil,
thank you.
Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor and writes the weekly Political Junkie column at npr.org. You can also hear him here every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation. Coming up after we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about the difficult situation of what do you say when there isn't anything nice to say at the funeral or memorial service for somebody who was, well, not so pleasant. We'll talk with the obituaries editor of The Economist, who writes those things for a living. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.